Austin Taylor now looking for Matt Smith, working it down the line. That one is denied. Matt Smith trying to tow it. A great is back into the fray. Hammerfield connects. What a play there from the Atlanta Hustle as they go up one.
Oh, great defensive play there from the Soul. Matt Smith stays with the disc, gets himself a highlight play there. Wait for Haverfield to stay with it, knowing that might be coming. And that's just a wonderful play to make.
Welcome back. This is Swing Pass. I'm Adam Ruffner. That is Cameron Brock. Today, the UFA Game of the Week schedule dropped on the website. You should go check that out, as well as Evan Lepler's great breakdown of all 13 games that will be featured only and exclusively on WatchUFA.tv, live throughout the entire regular season. That will be, of course, complemented by the free and YouTube-available Super Series games, of 8 of premier matchups from around the league. So there will be 2 different watching showcases, as well as the full slate of UFA regular season action coming up in just over 7 weeks. And Cam, you just got through with your first big practice weekend with the Alley Cats. You guys got to really familiarize yourselves with the new disc. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about what you guys have looking for going into 2024, what you're expecting of on this team? What are some highs and lows you guys are anticipating? Just give it to me, man. Like, how's it heading into the first real sense of preseason here?
Yeah, it was good. It was a great weekend. Always great to get out there and kind of feel like the season has started. We actually had another super weekend a few weeks ago.
I was trying to give you an out there.
I know.
Putting you on blast. You're usually Mr. 100% attendance. We didn't have to pull back the curtain out and let everyone know you bailed on the first set of OTAs.
I was moving, you know. Like,
if this is a different sport, though, it would be so funny, because if you had missed that, it would be like, league scoring leader misses first practice. What is the spell for Indy season, you know?
Is there turmoil in Indianapolis? Waiting on that contract extension, you know? I'm not playing, not getting out there and risking that injury. I'm just kidding. I don't get injured.
I think there's actually maybe been like a soft holdout or two in this league's history of somebody maybe wanting a little bit more team swag or something in their contract. But like, yeah, you could be a first official league holdout, I bet. I don't know how the bargaining rights would go, but.
Yeah.
I've detracted way too far. I was just saying you gotta be better. You gotta be more nimble.
You're
here.
Right.
You gotta pave right over the fact that you didn't make the first practice weekend. This was the first practice weekend for you, but the second one for the Alley Cats as a team.
I will say this one, kind of, even for people who went to the first one, it kind of felt like the first real one. Just we were doing some things in the first week, and a lot of times the first weekend is logistics and kind of figuring out systems and like how practices are going to run. We got so many new people we're trying to integrate. So, but this one really felt like, in talking with some other people, it kind of felt more like our first team practice. So that can make me feel a little bit better, I guess. But I'm excited. I mean, we're returning a lot of our top guns from, you know, previous seasons. People who are familiar with franchise and who have a lot of AUDL experience, or sorry, UFA experience. They do have AUDL experience. They're about to get UFA experience.
No one's got UFA experience. Completely flat playing field entering into this new season.
Yeah, there were people joking this weekend that, you know, Cameron, you're not the all-time UFA scoring champion. You haven't scored a goal in the UFA yet. So I was like, well, I guess I just got to go score the most goals this year, then if that needs to continue to be my moniker, I guess I got to go out and put my money where my mouth is. But it was good. We had great weather. You know, we've had some really good weather here in the Midwest recently. It's been unseasonably warm, so got a couple practices in the mid-50s to mid-60s, which is pretty fortunate for this time of year. You could end up with, you know, 20s and snow, and we got really lucky there. We had really high attendance too, which was great. You know, sometimes in these, you never know what you're going to get attendance wise, especially with college guys who might still have commitments to their college team. But we were able to get pretty much almost everyone there. Got a lot of good time together on and off the field. You know, we got some of our new players in, you know, learning our systems and starting to get used to those. And it, I thought the best part for me was just seeing the tangible difference from day one to day two and how smooth things were running and how comfortable people were getting on the field. As far as the disc goes, I mean, I think I saw one throw maybe the whole weekend where I was like, yep, that's somebody who just isn't quite used to the new disc. And it was just a backhand huck that, you know, if you keep this disc flat and it's like a completely flat throw, it does sometimes kind of tend to go a little bit IO. So they were throwing near a sideline to begin with and tried to keep it flat, and it just hung a little outside. Outside of that one throw, it really, like, it's just playing Frisbee, man. The disc isn't that different to where people aren't going to be able to make these small adjustments. It really doesn't affect any short throws. Like, any non-hucks really shouldn't be affected at all in terms of, like, getting used to the disc. It's really only that those longer throws and just knowing kind of what shape to put on it. One thing I do really love about the new disc, and I know somebody out there is going to be like, he's just pushing the disc because he plays in the UFA and he's on swing pass. But, like, no, like, one thing I really love about this disc is that when you put a shape on it, it holds that shape. So, you know, some of us might be used to the Discraft Ultrastar, where if you put, like, a lot of OI on it, for instance, it will turn over even more. You might release it at a 45-degree angle, and it might finish at a 60-degree angle, just to put some numbers to it. But with this disc, you put it at a 45-degree angle, it's going to hold that angle. So it actually makes kind of predicting where the disc is going to end up, I think, a lot easier, because you know the angle you put on it is the angle that it's going to finish at. Now, in high wind situations, might this look a little different? Sure. We were playing in some pretty mild wind this weekend, so we didn't really have much of that to mess with. But I mean, I can tell you, I feel like it has a very true flight path. Like, what you put on it is what you're going to get. And I didn't really see it affecting too many people. I mean, I saw some beautiful hucks out there from guys like Xavier Payne. He is a guy that throws a lot and used to throw a lot with the Discraft disc, and he doesn't seem like he's having any problems adjusting to the new disc whatsoever. So I think anyone who's worried about that, I know people are like asking me all the time who don't have the discs, what's it like? Like, are you worried about the new disc? Not at all. Like, it's been a pretty seamless transition. Yeah, I mean, great weekend. I still feel really good. The thing I always wonder after the first Super Weekend is, how's my body feel? Like, how's my body?
I was going to say, you've been hitting, without fully endorsing, but you've been on the Tobu fitness plan this whole offseason. How are you feeling, you know, now entering year 12 of your career?
I'm feeling great. I mean, I woke up Sunday for practice feeling like almost like I didn't do anything the day before. And then I woke up Monday after the second practice and I just had the tiniest amount of soreness, like almost like I had just done a tough workout the day before, like I had lifted the day before. But like when I lift, like am I a little sore? Sure. But it's like barely noticeable because I lift regularly for it. So it's not like where I'm, oh my gosh, I can't walk. I went out on a nice run yesterday, went out and did a speed workout today, 2 days removed from our super weekend, speed and agility workout, and feel great. Definitely Tobu Fitness, I think, is a big part of that. Like, gives me something, you know, it's made by somebody who knows more about this stuff than I do. For instance, I do not study, you know, movement stuff, the, outside of just the movement I do have done my whole life. But, no, Justin Shelby, Tobu Fitness. Definitely, like, I will put my stamp on it. I will endorse that guy. I love what I've been
doing. No, we can't. Nope. I gotta file a whole different kind of publishing thing here. If you start an actual endorsement on this show, we haven't had that yet.
He gets the Cam Rock stamp of approval.
Worth and stuff. FCC is gonna come down on me. Like, I don't want to go down this path, Cam. You gotta retract.
That's fine.
But, quick shout out, Tobu Fitness. He's been doing great stuff on social media for the past couple years. And it's really great hearing that as you progress into your career. I don't want to call it the twilight years, because maybe you're going to Brady on all of us and just extend into dimension in your 40s that we didn't know of yet. But it sounds like the over-under right now for your goal scoring this year is at like 40, 50 maybe again. You're going to lead the league again?
I'm not going to put a goal number on there because, for a lot of reasons, but
player.
But number one is just like, I really would just like to put a nice big win number out there for the team. So we've improved.
Double digits?
Yeah.
Cat's going to win. If we're going to improve,
double digits is the only place to go, because we had 9 regular season wins last year. So I would love to get into the double digits and get up to, you know, 10, 11 wins. That would be great. That would be amazing. I would just love to continue to see us grow in that win column for a third year in a row. So that's my goal. That's my goal. If I score a lot of goals in the process, great. But if I don't and we're winning, great. Like that's the priority. I know early in my career, people were like, you just go out there, like, oh, you care about your goals. And I'm like, no, not at all. Like, scoring goals is fun. I mean, no one's ever scored a goal and been like, oh, this sucks. But, you know, it's like, at the end of the day, like, I care about the team scoring. And if I happen to be catching it, cool. Like, cool. That's totally fine. But I don't know.
I'm willing to totally test this theory throughout the season and just keep dangling that catnip above you of, you're 10th right now all time in UFA, all time leading goal scorers. You're 20th right now as a UFA goal scorer. I'm not going to let you get away with the 600 odd goals you've already collected. You're on a new league now, Buster. You need to up those numbers, man.
All right. I guess we'll see what happens.
That's great. And you know, you guys do have the second easiest strength of schedule according to Daniel Cohen's rankings that he came out with a couple weeks ago in the full schedule drop. So, you know, there is a pretty good possibility, especially if you guys pull out that road win in Colorado somehow, of you guys getting to maybe 10 wins again. I think that would be the first time in your franchise's history that you got to 10 wins during the regular season. But
I think that is right. Even during the 14... during the regular seasons that were a little longer, I don't think we ever quite got to 10. I think our best season was in 2019, where we were 9-3 in that season as well. I believe we lost at Chicago. We lost.
You did have an 11 win regular season in 2018, but there were 14 regular season games, so you did get one under the wire.
2018
season, man. Why don't you remember that season? You guys beat Madison for the first time that year. You blanked on that.
I think it's because of how badly it ended. Like how like you're right, because we beat Madison for the first time. We swept.
It's just I only tease you because you have one of the best memories I've ever been around, and like two of the more prominent features in Indy's franchise history, beating Madison for the first time, and it. 11 win regular season are just like memory hold somewhere for you.
It's because with the last two times we played them, I think they beat us by a combined 16 goals. I think I just try to forget how, because that was the thing, right? We beat them, and then it was the battle for the one seed. We go up, we're flexed into the game of the week up in Madison. They play a near perfect game offensively and beat us by like 8 goals. The game is never close. And then we go up there for the playoff game. Of course, we had to play a first round game against Minnesota, and we go up there and the same thing happens. They just play just this insane offensive game where they only have like 4 total offensive turnovers or something stupid like that. And, you know, we can't do any, you can't catch up when a team just keeps scoring and doesn't turn the disc over. And we you know, they won the title that year. They were clearly.
I was going to say, like, the lapel pin to hang here is that you were the last team to beat the 2018 champions that year. So just cut the memories off there. Just pull out the old thinking route and leave it there. Yeah. But we should move on from Alley Cats talk. I really thank you for walking us through that practice weekend, updating us about the disc. But we should move on to the bulk of this episode, and what Cam and I have been outlining going into it is overcoming your nemesis, kind of picking out 2 franchises each that we wanted to highlight and go through tactical observations and kind of strategies beyond just play better, find a star more, and really kind of give some insight into maybe what can help these teams overcome or get the monkey off their shoulder in particular matchups. And I think chief of mind is going to be the one that Cam takes right away, and that's, of course, the battle for the East That is New York DC, which I still refer to as a rivalry. I think that is the appropriate signifier for the matchup between these two teams. And that is in spite of the fact that if you look at the win-loss record for the past few years, it's all New York. Mm-hmm. But you have looked into this much more than I have, so I'll let you kind of take the ball from here.
Sure.
Disc. What am I saying? Frisbee, if you will.
Yeah. So it's really hard, right? Because we're definitely armchairing this a little bit, right? Like we're Monday morning quarterbacking this.
Oh, wait, dude, all I do is sit in a computer chair. All I can do is armchair.
You know, but I think there are some things like sometimes I think an outside perspective can be helpful too. Like you get so caught up in like mm-hmm. what you do that sometimes you can't see the bigger picture. And so we're going to try to armchair this looking down, you know, from a top down, like what do we see from the outside that kind of maybe could be some adjustments. So starting with, this is actually perfect timing that we're doing this because earlier today, New York announced that Vigneault has re-signed. Not that that's really a shock, but they officially put it out on social media. And we're going to talk about the Vigneault of it all when it comes to DC, because the last time these two teams faced each other, Vigneault put up the greatest individual game in league history. And I don't even think there's much room for debate on that. You can look at some games that maybe statistically from like, you know, like a game with, Goose Helton, I think, has a game with like 8 or 9 blocks or something, which is insane. Like, you could look at it from that perspective. But when you look at moment, it like the moment you're doing this in combined with the stats, nothing stands out more to me than this Vigneault game that he played against DC, where he, you know, yardage record, just seemingly unguardable, just going deep at will. And every time that disc went up, I don't think any of us had any doubt in our mind who was coming down with it. He was just, he's big game Vigneault. He is big game Ben. Like in a big game, he's going to show up. So what do I mean? Why am I talking about Vigneault when we're talking about overcoming your nemesis? Well, when it comes to DC, Vigneault must just salivate. Like he must just be looking forward to this more than everyone else because he seems to be the difference maker in like 80% of their games against DC. Even going back to their first matchup last year, that 18-17 game, who was the one coming down with the big catch and double coverage in, was it overtime when that happened? It's Vigneault. It's him. He is inevitable.
2022 East Division Championship game. His birthday. He catches the game winner from Jack Williams at the end of regulation. As time expires, you even go back to 2018 and kind of the hinge point of this entire rivalry in the modern sense when there was that monsoon game. Evan Lepler wrote about it in the Game of the Week preview article earlier today, that there was that monsoon game in the first round of the playoffs where New York held DC scoreless in the fourth quarter. There actually wasn't a score in the game, and Vigneault had a couple of big plays in the rain earlier in that matchup. And mm-hmm. it's just like, to your point, he just seems to be this like, evil entity for DC almost every season.
Yeah, and I think like when we look at Vigneault, like, and you look at how well he plays against DC, I'm looking at it right now, their game, their 21-18 win, he's 100% completion percentage. He's putting up over 300 yards as a defensive player in that game. When we look at the game on May 13th, the 18-17 game, right, he is putting up, again, like 250 to 300 yards and making the biggest catches of the game. Like he's there in the moments that matter the most. So what I really want to look at though is like, what do we do about Vigneault? Because he seems to be such a big part of these games. If he's not the whole game, at least in the big moments. Jeff Babbitt obviously also had some tremendous games against DC last year. So Vigneault isn't the whole picture here, as he never will be because New York is so talented across the board. But I think one thing that you might want to do is try to exploit what happens when Vigneault touches the disc a lot. Because Benyat, for all of his accolades, for all of the things that we can praise him for, he's an interesting case study because he has never in his career, you know, he's been playing since 2014, he has not developed into a better thrower and decision maker really through that time. Or maybe a better thrower, but not a better decision maker. His career completion percentage hovers under 90%. He was under 87% last year, under 90%.
He was on defense last year, so he was like a little bit more encouraged to just get the disc out quickly in transition. I will say that, but to your point, not great. Not great.
Well, even if you want to go back to 2019 when he won the MVP, one thing that people don't really talk about is how many turnovers he had. He was a turnover machine in 2019. He was just also putting up such ridiculous score numbers that people kind of would look past it.
And because he finished that season by not having a turnover at championship weekend when it mattered most, it was one of those kind of inversions of a lot of MVP candidates where he, to your point about Big Game Ben, elevated to his best self when they needed it most and closed out an undefeated season with the title by having like 11 scores and no turnovers in a championship game. So
yeah, but I mean, during the regular season, 24 throwaways and 7 drops. I mean, 31 turnovers by the guy who was the MVP as a receiver, right? Like this isn't 24 turnovers from somebody who's throwing the disc 50 times a game. This is 24 turnovers from somebody who's, you know, on that season had 241 completions. We're not looking at like Brandon Van Dusen numbers from last year where he's up over 550. So I think if there's one thing you can do, like, you just can't let him beat you deep. And I think that sounds like such an elementary principle. Like, well, I'm sure they're trying not to get beat deep. I mean, throw two people back there. Having a free safety almost at all times, like who is just ready to help off on Benyat. I think especially in a game where if he is on offense, which they lost John Lithgow this year, does that mean Benyat slots back in on offense? We don't really know what that's going to look like yet. But if they slotted him in there for the playoffs, and even when everyone was kind of back and available, they kept him on that side of the disc. So are we seeing the transition back to O-line Benyat? And if we are, I think you got to find ways to get him the disc in the middle of the field, get him in the disc somewhere other than in the end zone, because he has proven throughout his career, whether he's playing O-line or D-line, that he is going to turn the disc over. It's the reason he went to the D-line in the first place, because he was making bad decisions. 2021, he was offense the whole year, right? Under 91% completion percentage. So, I mean, we're looking at someone who is turnover prone, who is going to force the issue more than he should. And I think that's something you kind of have to play into. Usually you're not saying, hey, let's try to get someone who might be the other team's best player. Let's try to get the disc in their hands more. But in this case, the thing is, if you can get him the disc not in the end zone, he's going to turn the disc over. He's going to give you opportunities. And you just kind of have to do it at all costs. If that means having somebody who's playing loose on their guy in an attempt to make sure that Benyat's never running deep in one-on-one coverage, I think it's worth taking that risk. But clearly we've seen that whatever DC has tried for the past, five seasons hasn't worked. You have to try to adapt and try something else.
Well, what you're saying reminds me so much. And one of the kind of athlete comparisons that I like to draw up in my head with Benyat, and obviously take this with a huge grain of salt, but in terms of they get detracted for their skills in the wrong ways, but there is sort of a truth to it. Benyat, Giannis, Antetokounmpo. Like they're, you know, in the same way that you might not immediately associate thrower with Yacht, in the same way that you would associate ball handler or deep bag with Giannis, these are kind of the detractions against either of their skill sets that I think are both true in a sense and wholly false. Because like the counterpoint to your sort of stat analysis of Yacht's mistakes, I think, is watching the games and seeing how New York utilizes him as the trigger puller during those seasons. I mean, in 2019, there wasn't Osgar, so he had to take more of those volume roles. 2021, it was first year of Osgar and kind of the kingdom of Yacht still, so he's just entitled to that. I think one of the most impressive parts about Yacht's game throughout the years is that he adapts so well to every given lineup that he is situated on. There is no more intelligent player I think, almost in the league at understanding his role on his given team than Beignat. And to your point about the East Division Championship performance last year, I mean, he went from playing defense all year to just being the standout guy, maybe of all time, in a big game performance. But to get back to the Giannis comparison, it's like, you do want to make Yacht a thrower in the same way that you want to make Giannis a ball handler, not in that their skills are necessarily bad there, but it is the worst part of their game, mm-hmm. because the alternative is Giannis catching it in the restricted area where he becomes Shaq. The opposite of Yacht being a thrower is him going downfield in one-on-one and setting a receiving record in an elimination playoff game, as he did against DC. You know, you've got to kind of figure out, okay, this is sort of an immutable force here. There's going to be something that he, you know, contributes to this game, but how can we force him into his most mistake-prone version?
Exactly. Like, when you have a great player, you know, and that's the thing that's kind of similar in basketball and ultimate, is that, like, you're kind of asked to do everything. Like, you can't just play offense. Like, you do have to show up on the defensive end in some ways, right? Like, you can't just be somebody who catches the ball, especially in today's NBA. You have to be able to handle the ball to some extent. It's kind of the same way, right? Like, yeah, Beignat, if you just put him out with a bunch of people and we're like, yeah, throw this disc, like, he'd be as good as almost anyone else. But in the game, yeah, he just sometimes, you want him to get the disc more because he is more prone to, like, trying to force the issue when he doesn't need to.
He overcooks in the same way that Giannis does with the ball. Like, they just, there's something about the size, the ability to dominate, where I think they just overheat a bit. Mm-hmm. They get a little too dominant almost. It's just forcing the issue. And especially in New York, when they have so many other options, it's like, yeah, you really don't have to take these looks. We got to be aggressive, but, like,
yeah. So I think, like, defensively, they just, like, I think Yacht's going to be playing more offense this year with the absence of John Lithia. Like, this is just literally me looking from the outside and saying, well, who's going to slot in there? Well, who would be the most natural person to slot in on offense? The person who has played all these stats on offense. I think finding ways to limit his effectiveness is crucial. And I think if you have to put two guys, a free safety, basically, you do that. Now, I think the bigger thing that they can do, because it's something they have a little bit more control over, is offense. Offensively, if you look at all the stats, you're going to be like, Cam, you're an idiot. Why are we talking about DC's offense? Like, you look at the stats say they're great. And I get that. The stats say they're great. But the eye test can kind of reveal some things that are not so great about their offense. The first thing we talk about is just lineup. Like, I've talked multiple times on this podcast, and I will probably harp on this throughout the season as we kind of see whose lineups stay more consistent and whose lineups seem to be fluctuating week to week. Would love if we get some more analysis by Comet. He did a great job putting out an amazing graphic last year about teams' roster consistency week to week, and I thought that that was a really cool way to visualize what this is all about. But looking through their roster, I just did a search basically through them to see how many O points people played, who was playing the most O points, and they did have four people who were pretty consistently on the O line. Like, so Christian Boxley, let's see, Boxley, Monroe, Roy, and Mox. They were all there for 219 or more points. And you can't really compare it to the league because of styles and stuff. So you really have to look, like, individually on the team. Because, you know, obviously a team like DC, who plays a slower style of offense, is probably going to have less offensive points throughout the season because there's just less points played. So Johnny Mox led the way with 257 offensive points played. Christian Boxley is lowest on that list of four with 219, but that's a pretty reasonable spread. But after that, the next closest person was Jeff Wodach at 181. And then you have Rowan at 168 and some people hovering around the mid to low 100s. And you start to realize by the time you get through all this, they had 11 different players that played 100 or more O points last year. And I've talked about this and I will continue to harp on this, but, like, that is not a recipe for success, especially in big moments. And I think this is kind of where I'm hammering this point home, is when push comes to shove, when you're in the biggest game of the year, what's your seven? Like, what is your seven? Do you even know what your seven is? And I think we see consistently with DC that in these big games, it just doesn't seem to all click the way it needs to. Now, all credit to DC. They didn't play a terrible game in the East Division Championship game. They ran up against an all-timer from New York. But even in the games where New York's not putting up all-timers, DC just looks like they're just not quite on that level. And they don't look comfortable all the time. Just because a throw is completed doesn't mean it was completed easily, doesn't mean it was done with comfort. And I think when you watch their games against the better teams, you can visibly see that, something that doesn't show up on the stat sheet. And the difference is when you're playing a team against like New York, who's so good defensively, has so many players who are good at staying tight on their person. Those really tough throws that DC likes to make all the time, those tight window, short throws, IOs to the front of the stack, whatever, if they're off even by just a few inches, a team like New York is going to pounce on those. And I think that's what we've kind of seen throughout the years, is that that margin for error just isn't there against the better teams.
Yeah, I think all of those points are really valid. And what I especially like is you moving beyond just the statistical analysis of DC's offense, because I think it can be so alluring and kind of distracting in a way when you talk about their faults. Because again, you go back and you look, and particularly within the context of these New York matchups, you say, well, the Empire just sort of played better. I know that's a very flat analysis, but it's kind of true when you just go look at some of the box scores and the way in which New York simply executed at a higher rate. But your point about how DC's offense relies so much on those synaptic connections, those quick movement, almost intuitive, tweening throws, tight spaces, that is so reliant on a kind of lineup consistency that the numbers just don't bear out for this Breeze team. I mean, you can add up all of the skills of these individual throwers, and I think it stacks higher than almost any other team in the league, including New York. But without that chemistry, without the simple reps, you can't just rely on the paper notion of, well, but it's Jock Nissen, Cole Jurek, Andrew Roy, Roe McDaniel, you know, these names, these big performers, but there's got to be that chemistry, again, intuitiveness that they rely on so much to make that offense move.
Yeah, I think like it's hard to feel confident in the biggest moments of the season when you don't have that battle tested, just seven people who are there week in and week out and have been in those situations together. There is something to be said for facing adversity together and what that can do for not just the ability to kind of have those synaptic connections that you mentioned, but also just the comfort at which you feel with every other person on the line. When you've been battle tested together, you don't have to have even the tiniest seed of doubt in the back of your mind about like, oh, hey, you know, player X over there hasn't really been here in any of our tight games. Like, I hope they are ready for this. I hope they're not over there freaking out. I hope they feel confident. And it's at the same time, it's like, maybe you feel great, but if someone over there is, you know, wetting their pants a little bit or feeling really tight, those connections aren't going to be there. Like, they just aren't going to be there. I mean, it's one of those things that's kind of hard to quantify, especially given such roster inconsistency from them on offense. It's like really hard to try to go quantify it because they've all played so many points with so many different combinations of that seven that it's like, which one is the best version of this offense? And I think you mentioned off air that it seemed like sometimes it would almost go with the hot hand of the night. Like, oh, you know, Healy's playing really great tonight, so we're just going to run with Healy for like 0 points tonight. Or, man, it really looks like Cole Jurek is on. Like, he's going to run tonight. But that's kind of the problem, right? Like, this isn't like basketball where somebody's just like on a heater and they're just knocking down three-pointer after three-pointer. This is a team game. The game has to the disc is constantly moving from person to person to person, and everyone's going to be involved. So I think just that style, while it might look great in the moment, I think when you get to the big games, like, it can be your downfall.
Well, and I think that's why with Christian Boxley seemingly reaching a next level last year as a playmaker for DC's offense, it kind of, I think, we almost like unifiedly agree raised the ceiling of their team. And of course, it led to a club championship in the amateur division for DC's franchise Truck Stop. But like, that didn't play out in the pro scene. And I think maybe part of it was just, again, Antoine Davis being on a half season heater where he was just putting people on misery islands with his defense. You know, like, he just kind of took Boxley out of the fold, especially in the last three quarters of that game. Like, he had some scores early. He wasn't bad, but he just wasn't the pronounced force that had been able to sort of elevate and seemingly punch back against New York's, you know, MVP riddled lineup. But yeah, you said inconsistent offensive lineup, and I almost interrupted you and like balked at it, and you're totally correct. There's just something about it, and this is my own sort of like bias or blindedness here. It's like the way in which they roll out that 11 deep offensive rotation, I think about it as being like creative. You're seeing what works. You're seeing how the lineups mesh with each other. Why wouldn't you want to see what the combinations yield when you have this many throwers? But to what you're saying, sort of the flip side of that is it's inconsistent. It's just inconsistent. Like, you can't have 11 people rotating into seven spots and call it anything other than inconsistent. Like, it's just, it's hard. It's tough.
I guess going along with this, and I know we want to move on to some other teams, but I think offensively, like, can we move on? Can we move on to a different style of offense? Because right now, like, we've talked about this style of offense where they're making these tight throws all the time, and like, they feel very comfortable doing that. But the problem is that it doesn't lend itself to performing well against heavy pressure with teams that have really great individual defenders, because those throws become even tighter. Tight throws become even tighter, and that's never something you want to say about your offense. So what I really love to see is actually something similar to like what Chicago was doing in 2021 and 2022, which is where the handlers kind of get the disc upfield and then kind of disappear until they're needed again. I would love to see more cutter-to-cutter connections with deep throws, because as is the case actually with a surprising amount of teams, I think most people think, wow, like, there's these great throwers. Like, we think of a Jonathan Nethercutt, we might think of a Mac Hecht, you know. You might think like, man, those guys' huck numbers must be insane. And then you go and look and you're like, the best huck thrower on Colorado, the top two huck throwers on Colorado aren't handlers. Like, they're guys who are out there cutting and then continuing. And I mentioned this last week, but when you are throwing from deep from the cutter space, you just have less people downfield that can possibly interfere. You know, if I catch a disc 20 yards upfield and I've got four of my teammates behind me plus their defenders, that only leaves four other people on the other side that I have to contend with. Two of my guys, two of their guys. That's going to be a much higher percentage look, because you're just going to have more space to work with and less obstacles to work with. That's just kind of simple math. And when you look at the hucking numbers just from a pure percentage standpoint on DC, outside of Christian Boxley, who had zero, which is fine, because usually he's the person chasing down the long disc, kind of makes sense. But when you look at it, you have guys that are completing at high clips. They might not be throwing a ton of them throughout the season, but you have guys who, like Jeff Wodatch completing 83%, Ben Ord at 78%, Cole Jurek completing 80% of his hucks, Monroe completing 63% of his hucks. I mean, these are all like serviceable to great numbers from a percentage standpoint. But the way their offense is set up, they're not getting a lot of opportunities to do that, because it is all this kind of dink and dunk, small ball, and they're getting the disc like with not a lot of momentum, with not a lot of separation. And sometimes when they're getting the disc, they're actually getting it so close to the handler space that there's still like 6 to 8 people upfield that they have to contend with. So the opportunities just really aren't there. Johnny Malks did complete 63% of his, which is fine. Like, that's serviceable. He's their highest volume deep thrower, so 63% isn't terrible. You'd really like to see that close, a little closer to 70%, but considering the amount he threw and considering how bad they were from some other throwers, that's not bad. But like, then you look at like someone like Rowan McDonald, who has a million different ways to throw a disc, completed 33% of his hucks last year and only completed 90% of his throws. And I realized that like, He did have a really bad game against Carolina where he played 20 D points and only one offensive point and completed like what 70% of his, about 72% of his passes. But like, that's a season long trend. And I think we talked, I think it was 2 years ago, it was the whole row into D line thing. I think that might need to be a permanent move at this point. Because you just can't be completing at 90%, in this league if you want to be effective. And if you're going to be someone who's throwing deep, you can't just be somebody who is only able to throw deep at that percentage. Like at that point, you can't throw deep anymore. Like we clearly need to rein that in. But I think when you look at some of those numbers, it'd be interesting if they could run a different style of offense where they allow their cutters to get a little bit more out in space and kind of have some numbers downfield. Can they push the disc from their handler space instead of 10 yards upfield? Can they push those passes 20 to 25 yards upfield to create some more of these throwing opportunities? I think that would definitely make them more competitive in the deep space. And then when New York's playing against them, they can't just sit on these unders and almost like time up the DC offense to where they know this tight throw is coming and they know where it's going. Got to become a little bit more unpredictable if you're going to beat a great team like New York. They can't know everything you're going to do.
Yeah. Speaking of one of the people that you brought up as being a good continuation hucker, Ben Ort, I also felt like Boxley added a different dimension to their offensive attack that they didn't always have throughout the last several years. Ort felt the same way where, you know, Wodach, Monroe, fantastic continuation throwers, Cole Jurek too last year in his first DC season. Something about Ort, there's like there's an explosiveness to when he decides to activate as that deep thrower. He's got this big windup, especially on his backhand. Mm-hmm. He can just kind of unload. And when you watch him ripping into space to Monroe or Boxley just tracking it down, I mean, that looks like a dimension I would like to see from the Breeze more often. But want to move on to our next team. I'm going to take another East team, Philly. And I'm going to be a little cheeky and say that it's their nemesis is New York, DC, and Boston now all rolled into one. Obviously, Philly made the playoffs in 2022 when they held an edge over the Glory. But last year, Boston sort of retook the mantle, put Philly back out of the playoffs for, I believe, the 10th time in 11 years. But Phoenix still is one of the hard-charging and most fast-evolving teams in the league, and they are so close to kind of overcoming this hurdle in front of them as the fourth team in a three playoff seed division in the East. It's just not quite there yet. You know, they were 0-6 last year against those three teams combined, and in particular, they struggled at the start of games. They were just 1-6 in winning the first quarter against Boston, DC, and New York last year. And as a result, it just left them playing from behind a lot. And I think one of the things that we've really learned about this Philly team is that when they don't dictate, there are times when they can get a bit desperate with the disc and I think lose focus. Now, last year, they did a much better job than any other season prior in not letting the wheels come completely off. But there were just times where it felt like, because again, they're having their biggest games start out with basically one foot in the bucket, that they're being more reactive in how they're playing some of these games against DC, I think in particular, than what they would like to be. And so it just comes out to being, I think, a little bit quicker with the draw, hitting the ground running and really making the game what they want to make it. Because it felt like they were able to do that in their big, big win in week 6 against Carolina. Now, obviously, the Flyers were playing their second game in as many nights, but Philly knew that they could take advantage of them because of that, and they did. And it just feels like so many times when they face off against, again, the three playoff teams of the East in Boston, New York, and DC, that they have this image of kind of being the little brother in the matchup. I know there's this online boisterousness and a lot of vocal elements that play into it, but when you look at how they emerge or come out in these games, it's a little flat. And you just can't do that in the East Division. This is too tough of a division. You've got arguably two of the top four, if not two of the top three, if not two of the top two teams in the league in DC and New York. There's just not margins for you to think of yourselves as plucky and up next and expect it to just come through the next time. And so they've got to start off on a hotter foot. they need to get into the red zone more. You know, they were good once they were there against these three teams. I think they had above 80% overall as far as a conversion rate, which is very, very respectable in their six games against DC, New York, and Boston. But they just lacked raw attempts in that close proximity to scoring, you know, against DC in a two-goal loss, 10 of 12, great efficiency numbers. 12 isn't a super high red zone total. Against Boston the week prior, a one-goal loss, they had just 11 red zone opportunities. They converted 9 of them, 82%. Very, very nice. Their week 4 two-goal overtime loss to New York, only team last year to take New York to overtime, they had 10 red zone attempts. They converted 8 of them. They were really clean once they were in that space. But to me, that just tells me that Philly is settling a little bit too much for the mid-range or that long ball that they love. And it's just, they can't keep playing that kind of undisciplined frisbee against these teams specifically, right? Like, it's not to say it's a losing strategy overall. They just don't get the privilege of trying and failing against lesser competition, right? Like, I see sometimes this take of like, well, if Philly was in a different division, well, guess what? You're not. Like, this is your opponent. And so to keep kind of running into the same mistakes of, well, we really like taking these longer shots, we really trust our one-on-one matchups downfield, they need to make it less sexy. They need to bring the disc within scoring range and simply get more easy punch-in opportunities. You know, just thinking of how I associate with this Philly team, it's not them grinding out red zone opportunities. I have a bunch of examples for DC and New York and a host of other teams, Salt Lake, in this league. Philly, it's taking shots. And I just think that they've got to reduce the number of hucks and exchange those for opportunities within the red zone. And then my final point for filling these matchups, they've got to play a little bit more tougher once they do turn the disc on offense. Their defense last year was top three in defensive efficiency. Their offense was bottom 10 in opponent break rate. And what that means is that teams are finding some success in simply just converting breaks against their offense. Now, Philly did a much better job last year of limiting overall turnovers, but opposing defenses were fairly efficient in punching those in. And so they have the personnel to do this. They, you know, they have James Pollard, Sean Mott, Greg Martin is good in transition as an athlete. Like, they have, I think, players who can make this a little bit more sturdy, but there's something lacking there right now. And I don't know if that's a little bit more of a mental thing. I don't know if that's, again, kind of starting off in these first quarter deficits and then maybe taking a second when there's a tough turnover at a critical point later. You know, it could be a little bit beyond the numbers, but to me, I just look at how defenses are able to convert against Philly, how specifically the Empire, Breeze, and Boston were all pretty darn efficient and just got a lot of break opportunity chances. There's again, I think, a need for Philly to just tighten up. I know that that's kind of the sentiment that we get to with this team over the last couple of years. I think Charlie Hoppus put it really great before one of their matchups with Philly, where what did he say? They love the long ball.
Fan friendly ultimate.
It is like they are so presentable. Them in Philly, man, or Seattle. Like, you just watch them for some of their offensive possessions, and it's like, that's it as far as an entertainment product. But it's not serving them in these close games. And so I think they just need to kind of get back to brass tacks, which is red zone opportunities and not giving up easy scores in transition.
Yeah. And I think you talk about, you know, maybe not playing such a fan friendly style of ultimate and being a little bit more choosy. I think
DC plays one of the least fan friendly styles of ultimate. Yeah. And they have been one of the most successful franchises. New York, even last year, a lot of games where they weren't necessarily playing fan-friendly ultimate.
Yeah. To be fair, there was also a few games New York played in where they didn't have fan-friendly weather. So there was some of that
as well. This is true.
I think so. One thing that'll be cool to see this year is Calvin Tresolini. Like, he had a great first year, coming in. And I mean, coming into his first year in the league, completing 93.5% of his passes in a high volume role is pretty impressive. And also, like, you talk about somebody who needs to take those shots. He was completing his hucks in the mid to high 70% range. Like, that, and that's kind of the problem. It kind of feels like everyone has this license on Philadelphia to just kind of throw it deep whenever they want to. And it doesn't seem like there's a lot of repercussions for that. You know, I feel like as good of a job as I think the coaching staff has done in Philly into turning that franchise into being competitive, whereas I could go back a few years to when they were just like bottom of the barrel, very uncompetitive franchise. One thing I would really love to see is just more accountability for the players who are consistently making bad decisions with the disc. I think something else that was mentioned on a previous pod, you may have mentioned this, is just like Jordan Ryan kind of getting back to the shape he was in 2022. He did come in last year and like physically just looked like he wasn't quite in as good a shape as he was the year before. He certainly didn't play quite as cleanly last year as he did the previous season. I would love to see if he can get back to 2022 Jordan Ryan. But to your point, when we're talking about getting the disc back on offense, I've played on, you know, I've been playing offense for a long time. I've had seasons where we were really good at getting the disc back. And in 2022, we were one of the worst at getting the disc back. And I think there is a little bit of that mental side that can take over where it's like, man, we've kind of had several games in a row now where when we turn the disc over, we just can't get it back. Like, what's the issue here? Sometimes it does come down to a bit of conditioning, but I think there is that mental component to it too, right? Sometimes, you know, if you're used to playing offense, you can sometimes, and I think we can all relate to this in some way, you can find that extra gear when you're exhausted to make a cut. Like, you can just find that extra gear you need even though you're exhausted. And sometimes mentally, it's harder to turn that on when you're doing something you're not out there to do, which is play defense. Like, you go out there because you're supposed to hold the disc, you're supposed to score. And when you do turn it over, can you mentally continue to turn it on and be like, okay, I need to go get the disc back. I need to push through the fatigue. And I think sometimes there's almost like this visible change in a player when they go from one side of the disc to the other. It's one of those things that's not going to show up on a stat sheet. We don't have like a got scored on analysis, or we don't really have an analysis where it's like the person this player was guarding was catching the disc. Like, I would love to in the future.
I mean, I'll just say straight up, players are lucky we don't have that right stat yet. I feel like that'd be the most exposure imaginable. Oh. And people wouldn't handle it too well if you could just ascending sort like percentage no. scores for an individual defender. I would love that personally, oh. but
well, and like,
that'd be a revolution, man.
Yeah, thinking about the other side, like, I would love to look like at Antoine Davis's numbers last year on defense, like how few times his person was getting it when they were making a cut. But it's one of those things too where like that's only something you can notice in watching the game, right? And I think also it just kind of comes down to like how are the players playing in the big games, right? Like we've talked about like, how are your biggest players performing in the biggest games of the season? And that can be a big thing to look at too. And I think the problem with Philly is when you look at their biggest games last year, they never had all their players playing their best games. Some players stepped up, some players took a back seat.
So a point that I almost made, but it was a little too wishy-washy and kind of cosmic woo-woo-y, is they need top performances from offense and defense. I feel like they're one of the teams that is star-crossed in the way that, hooray, our offense is 70% this game and our defense left 8 break opportunities on the table. Or our defense was 7 of 8 on defensive break opportunities and our offense missed 4 red zone. Like, they just, it's always something in the opposite direction for them. I truly do empathize with them in that condition as a lifelong sports fan. But man, yeah, to your point, I had something similar written down of just, can you get one full complete game? Can you just all 4 quarters, both lines, the whole conduction together? Like, It's hard, man. Like, it's just one of those things, again, like, we started off kind of saying at the top of the show, we don't want to get too far into play better, be more clutch, do better in the fourth quarter. You know, like, that's neither here nor there, and that's not really something that we can, or anyone can advise on. But, yeah, I wish they could get one more, just, like, complete game. Just a real sturdy, complete game. That's what it felt like against Carolina. Yes. That's how it felt when they were playing them. They got that lead, and they were just able to sit on it for the fourth quarter.
100%. All right. Well, I'm going to go through this one next one a little more quickly. I know we spent a lot of time on those first couple, but I'm going with one that really hits home, which is, how does Indianapolis overcome Minnesota? Since our break that we took from because of COVID, where we took this season off, Indianapolis has not beaten Minnesota. Not a single time.
It's 3 years for those listening at home. 3 years.
Three years. Now, you take this with a bit of a grain of salt, right? Because, like, all 3 years are not built the same. 2021, there probably wasn't a team that was hit harder by the taking the year off than the Indianapolis Alley Cats. We started the season with six players who had played for the Alley Cats before. Six total on the 30-man roster. I was talking to John Jones the other day, who is now my teammate again. I'm really glad to have him back from after we loaned him to Chicago for a couple of seasons. I'm glad he's back in Naptown. But we were talking about the lost season, the what-if year, because we were on that upward trajectory, bringing everyone back in 2020 and adding some really interesting pieces. And Carter Ray, who had come off of a pretty good defensive season in Atlanta, a Xavier Payne, who, you know, now is just one of the best players on our roster, like, without a doubt, and is a huge difference maker, along with a couple other pieces that we were going to add on. And, like, wow, like, we would have been legitimate title contenders that year. And then everyone was like, you know what? We're getting kind of old, so we're going to stop playing. So 2021 comes around. We don't have a lot of people left. But if you look at 2022, 2023, so the last two seasons, I really want to boil it down to the playoff games. Because in all four of the regular season matchups, there were some kind of funky lineup. We were both missing people. There was some weird lineup stuff going. So what happens when we match up our best versus your best? And what you see is just, like, losing in the margins, essentially. Like, it's kind of like you said, the offense plays well, but the defense doesn't convert as well, or the defense is doing great, but the offense just kind of falters. And when we look at what happened to us in the two playoff games against Minnesota, both games that were fairly competitive, we just weren't able to put the whole picture together the way we had during the season. You go back to last year's playoff game. We end up losing 21-18. I can tell you, just sometimes you feel like a game is a little closer than the final score, a 3-point game at the end. But this was one of those games where we had lots of opportunities. In fact, we had more break chances in that game than we had in our regular season game that was only a 2-goal loss. We had twice as many break chances and converted one less break chance in twice as many opportunities, right? Like, we were 4-for-12 on the season. We were one of the top converting teams when we got the disc with our defense. Two of nine, excuse me. We were 2-of-9. They were 4-of-12, excuse me. We were 2-of-9 after being 4-of-6 in our previous matchup. So half as many and three more opportunities. And we had converted at, like, 55-ish% throughout the season. So, like, if we're on our normal conversion percentage, that flips the game in our favor, right? Amount of turnovers. We were a team that was pretty consistently in the mid-teens. We coughed it up 21 times. So even in a game where we could have, you know, made up for the fact that our D-line wasn't quite converting as well, offensively, we had a few too many turnovers. We had 14 offensive turnovers. And in both of those games, the major difference was pulling. So what's the thing we need to do better? If I had to pick one thing, we know what Minnesota is going to do for a pull. We've seen it. We saw Cameron Lacy and Sam Bergmeier. There's no reason to believe they're not going to do similar things this year. that needs to be a point that we need to practice, because we were starting way too many possessions where we couldn't quite get the disc in our hands and ready to move until they were already on us. It sounds like such a simple thing, but it's not something you can practice very well, because not every team has a Sam Bergmeyer and a Cameron Lacey that they can practice against.
All right. Berglund.
Berglund, yes. Sorry. Bergmeyer is not the polar. Berglund is the polar. I'm sorry.
Brett Bergmeyer. Brett Bergmeyer. Sam Berglund. Sam Berglund. They're the Iceberg boys. I had to get this all right last year, so don't worry about it. It's no sweat. Two things. One, you are one of about like 12 different franchise representatives I've had tell me the fish was this big story about your 2020 aspirations. Like every
I'm sure
player in this league, I'm pretty sure, has retroactively applied the knowledge of like, we would have won it all that year, man. We would have won it all. And you should hear the roster that New York was gonna build that year.
Sure.
There might have been a Mimi Schmickle on that team. Like, who knows? Like, there was all kinds of crazy stuff about 2020, man. It never happened, so everyone gets a piece of that pie.
You know what? And I'm going to keep taking a piece of that pie, so because you can't tell me I'm wrong.
No, but excuse me. The other thing I wanted to say is that the affliction that Philly had of like just can't quite get it together against this team, that very much feels applicable in your matchups with Minnesota, where there is just something about whatever Minnesota brings as far as their lineup, their rotations, the strategies they implement against you guys, where they just kind of hold this edge. There's just this way in which I feel like they destabilize you in a way that no other team has really been able to the past couple of years. I mean, looking at, again, that turnover number, you had 21 turnovers in the elimination game. The only other game where you had more than 20 turnovers in your 14 games, was also against Minnesota when you had a season high 28. You know, the other games around those two Minnesota games, the numbers to your credit are like 12 turns, 13, 8, 12, 10, 10. Like, they're complete outliers in the rest of the data set of like the last 8 games of the season. And so it just seems like there's something more going on there than maybe particularly like the players themselves or the quote unquote talent level on display. I think there's something a little bit deeper there. And I think that to your point, it gets to handling the pulls. Like it is one of those things where the pulling just, it threw everyone off in a point of the offensive possessions where they had been so lackadaisically confident that they didn't have to really tighten up then, that I think a lot of teams got swept away. Like, I think it was kind of like a tide that came up further than they were expecting. You get these roller pulls and they come in super tight. The game moment catches up to you and it overwhelms. And it felt like, yeah, Minnesota got you guys with that. They got Madison with it. That's how they kind of took the Central last year. And it'll be interesting to see if in year two of the new era of pulling, if that kind of continues or if y'all will catch up. I, you know, have you guys experimented with this? I started to hear midway through last season with just people adapting of like adopting a specialized catch or puller catcher, like somebody who almost like was like a punt returner, like specialized in kind of reading it. Did you guys ever experiment with a role like that? Was there any kind of, you know,
Yes, kind of. Like, so the way we kind of adapt is because with their pulls, it almost seems like too dangerous to catch, because the thing, if you go watch Sam Berglund and Cameron Lacey throw these pulls, they're coming in bladey, but they're not coming in at high angles. So this isn't like when Abe Coffin was on the D-line and he's throwing them 100 feet in the air and you kind of have time to set up underneath it and kind of get your body ready. This is, the disc is never going higher than like 10 to 12 feet off the ground, and it's coming in super fast, super sharp. And like, you're going to have to try to catch it at your toes. So like, catching it kind of seems like most of the time just a bad idea. But what we did do, and unfortunately it was like one of those things where you would think this is something that we would have like tried to figure out ahead of time, but we would actually have me for a lot of it was just like, I'm going to stay back and my job is just to hunt where the pole is going and knock it down the second it touches the ground. So what we did was just kind of pulled someone back who wasn't going to be in the initiation of whatever we were doing to start kind of start the offense, and that person's going to help stop the disc. So that gave us just extra people to kind of be back there and keep it from rolling out of the back of the end zone. And when we did that, it actually worked really well. The problem is, the reason you almost aren't prepared for it is because they do occasionally launch the disc. And then, like, you kind of forget for a second, like, oh, the last pull wasn't a problem. Next thing you know, the disc is coming in. It's coming in so fast, you almost don't even have enough time to, like, run backwards to get behind it. So I think that's something we just have to kind of be more prepared. We need to designate another person to kind of help stop these pulls. And I think the other thing is, like, there is a between the, you know, the ears aspect of this too. Like, we also drop the disc more against Minnesota than any other team. And that is a totally right here in the brain space issue, right? Like, we had 21 turnovers, 7 of those were drops. And if you want to go back on our season and look at our drop numbers, we don't have anything close to that in a game against any other team. But there definitely is, I think, for some people on this team. I mean, some people playing with us have literally never beaten the Minnesota wind chill. Actually, a majority of our players are new to the team within the last 3 years and have never beaten them. So they don't have, I guess, that confidence to go back on. But, like, I always kind of point to, look, if we just catch the disc at our normal rate and maybe drop 1 to 2 discs throughout the game as opposed to 7, like, that's also, like, another place where, like, that's the difference. If you go to that game where you had 28 turnovers, go count the drops there too. I don't have the number off the top of my head, but I remember telling Coach Shepard, I don't know how much we have to change in our offense. We just have to catch the disc, which, like, there's no offense for that. You just gotta catch it. So I think we just need to be mentally, there's a mental toughness aspect to it that's a nebulous area to go to, but if there is a tangible thing we can do, it is just being more prepared and more ready to stop these pulls. But easier said than done with those guys over there, because they're really good at it.
No, you guys actually didn't really experience drops in that game. It was just good old fashioned throwaways. But I hear your point about drops. That's like one of the biggest identifiers in, like, what happened to this team. I remember a big one was when Madison upset Chicago midway through the 2021 regular season, mm-hmm. In like week 6, and Chicago had like 8 drops in that game. Just complete aberration of a performance. But yeah, I think you guys are getting there, but it just hasn't flipped yet for you. I think it must be like an indie franchise thing where you guys need to, like, concede years of games to one particular Midwest team then just, like, build up off of them, and then, like, leapfrog, springboard over them for a division title. And that's what you did with Madison.
So the montage. We're just adding to the montage.
Bringing it back. Same blueprint. For my team, my second team, my final team, I'm going to get cheeky again, and I apologize in advance, but Atlanta Hustle, your biggest nemesis is yourselves at this point. Like, past 3 seasons, I think that anyone who looks at this team on paper can easily identify them as a championship contender. I think especially last year with the way that they treated Carolina in that fierce rivalry down south, going up 3-1. Beating Austin during the regular season matchup that they had, it was a single game. They didn't have a road game at Austin, but they took care of business against the Soul when they did face them early on in the season. And yet, once again, at the end, it just kind of all comes apart for a Hustle team that just kind of has had that happen over the last several seasons, particularly since the pandemic year of 2020. You know, again, this is a team that for all intents and purposes and from its performances shows it's capable of being a championship contender. This is one of the last teams to beat New York. You know, they were the last team during the regular season to beat the Empire at Atlanta, basically straight up in a game where they showed that they could just be better than what had been considered the best team. And so for Atlanta, it gets back to a thing with Philly. It's red zone. Now, Philly was tidy in what they did in the red zone. Atlanta has not been in their elimination games. So in 2023, 2022, and 2021, and their actual elimination games in 2023 and 2021 in the playoffs, and then kind of their pseudo one on the road in week 11 of the 2022 regular season at Austin that effectively bounced Atlanta out of the postseason, In those three games, in none of them did they convert above 70% in the red zone. 70% would just be like bottom rung anyways, but to not even clear it once, you know, they were 12 of 18 this year in the elimination game, 11 of 16 last year, 6 of 9 against New York. That game went to overtime and they had 9 red zone attempts. And this is an Atlanta team that is great inside the red zone normally and has really good both personnel and I think systems for what to do at the disc in that position. And so they've just got to come up with a way to make scores easier for themselves. They have to find a way to get those easy points in. You know, these are games decided by a single goal and they're leaving 5-6 goals on the vine for themselves. And that's just tough for an Atlanta team that I think otherwise performs at that level. Again, it just kind of comes apart at the worst possible moments. And along with that, I think goes into my second point, more zone defense looks. And that's simply because I want Atlanta to sort of wrest control of the game tempo more. I think that while zone allows for players to get into a rhythm with higher touches, in a playoff environment, your opponent is already going to be feeding their stars. They're going to be spamming whatever buttons and combos they can to get the greatest yield. I think particularly in the South, that's kind of the approach. You feed your biggest players. And so I think a zone is a good look because it just allows you to put a little bit more of a cap on the tempo in the play. And I feel like when the Hustle do that and sort of leverage it against their increasingly more efficient offense, it just produces better results for them. I think you've seen particularly in the Austin game this past year in the New York playoff game in 2021, things just get out of hand for Atlanta and they end up being the sort of audience for a hellacious amount of highlight plays from their opponents, where second half of that 2021 game against the Empire, it's Jack Williams, Ryan Osgar, and Bagnat taking over for them. In 2023, it's Kyle Henke and Oliver Fay and Joey Wiley and kind of all of these stars that they had relied upon having great performances. And so I think a zone just would allow them a little bit more of an ability to, again, sort of soften the amount of explosives that happen against them in these environments. It's not necessary. These aren't fix-all solutions. And Lord knows what happens when you give an opponent like, you know, a Kyle Henke the opportunity to get 50-plus touches in a game. Maybe he goes off and does a Bagnat type of performance. Who knows? But I just think zone and their ability to throw it kind of into other defensive looks, it just gives them a leverage point that not a lot of teams have. And then the final one is sort of an inversion of what we talked about with DC, where it feels like when they find a hot hand, it's sort of in a desperation sense. I think for Atlanta, I would like to see them ride that hot hand more. It felt like particularly in this past year, Bobby Land, Draco, Austin Taylor started getting it going in the middle of that game. And it felt like towards the end, they still very much had sort of their hands on the wheel, but there wasn't as much certainty as to what the overall drives were doing, who was supposed to kind of get the disc. And so I'd love for Atlanta to kind of like focus on, okay, who's been performing well. You know, oftentimes we were talking about in the pre-show, it's been Matt Smith and they just can't find him at the end of games. So make things easier. Again, set up more red zone looks, isolate Matt Smith, get Christian Olsen the disc more. Olsen is somebody who I'd love to see get a little bit more touches at the end of this game, just because he's such a primetime performer and has been for years in this league. You know, again, I think with the hot hand in this case, it's simplify it, make it easier for yourselves. Who is going to carry us across the finish line? You know, don't get into the situation that DC sometimes gets into too, where it's all seven of us are great, but who's sort of going to carry this across? I just think, again, with Atlanta, it's not so much doing more or needing more. It's finding more through a simpler system or through simpler means. So again, it's back to the red zone. You got to keep it clean when you're that close, and then more defensive looks and a little bit more of an identifier of, you know, who's got that going in the big game.
Yeah, I think I'll kind of touch on a couple of your points. So the point about zone, like to me, the zone is even like less important if you're getting stops at the zone, but I've talked about this before. Sometimes the best part about a zone is that you just don't allow the offense to get into a rhythm. Like it, I can't underscore enough, like how difficult it can be to like go out in every other zone man on offense. Like offense, when you're running the against a person defense, you kind of can find your rhythm with like what's working, who's getting open, what matchups you like. And when you're not being able to do that point to point, and you're constantly having to switch back and forth, it can be a little bit jarring and it can be really hard to find that rhythm. We personally love playing against zone defenses. Like when Atlanta brings their zone out, we feel very comfortable against that. And like, that's like, we've spent so many years playing against the Madison zone, and the players, while we do have a lot of players who didn't play against that vaunted Madison zone, the players that we have playing on offense, we have seen that zone. We did play a lot of years against that zone. We do understand how to move the disc and how to be effective there. So we feel comfortable with that, but then it's just like, it makes the man points so uncomfortable because you're not able to consistently figure out what's working. And then to your point about finding stars, man, Matt Smith was so good last year. I mean,
he had a no-look greatest.
He had
in a playoff game.
Not just even in that game, but in like he had one throwaway on the entire season that he was credited with, which is insane for a guy who is playing pretty much every game and touching the disc, you know, 15-ish times a game. And just like I was looking at like, how does Matt Smith perform in playoff games? Phenomenally. He's great in playoff games. In the biggest moments when it matters most, Matt Smith is about as great of a player as you could get. Maybe he needs to be big game Matt Smith. We'll have him and Ben Yacht next to each other. Because I'm looking back through the four, well, he's played in five playoff games. He's completing 95% of his passes. He's got a plus 18. I mean, in their game last year, he was, 20 for 20 with the disc in his hands. Because again, he doesn't turn the disc over. He doesn't throw it away. He's got three goals, three assists. And to your point about what was happening later in that game, I felt like at the end of the game, I didn't know where Matt Smith was. And you can't tell me it's because he wasn't getting open. You're not going to tell me he was getting open all game and all of a sudden they solved the equation of how to stop Matt Smith. Because the thing is, despite the fact that Matt Smith is, you know, my age, we some old guys, he's still one of the quickest players on the field every time he steps on it. Even if you want to say he doesn't quite have the top end speed, which he's still really fast, I defy you to find somebody who is like, just hands down quicker than that man. He is so hard to guard in and out of his breaks. And when we think about the last time, you know, that turnover, the Kyle Hinkie big layout that we all remember from that game last year, you know who wouldn't be getting layout D'd by anyone because they wouldn't even be close to him in that small of a space? Matt Smith. I honestly would have loved in that situation, you're that close to the end zone, let your quickest, most sure-handed guy who has been there and seen it all and has always stepped up to the plate, let him be the person who takes you home in that situation. I would have been finding a way to ISO Matt Smith in that situation. And if they did that, we might be talking about this team. We might not even be talking about this team right now because maybe we would have seen them at championship weekend. I don't know. I would just love, to your point too about Christian Olsen, like he's someone who's not, Christian Olsen and Matt Smith are not at this point usually drawing the toughest matchups either. So I think it's just going to be easier for them to work. Brett Holzmaier took up so much of the oxygen in the cutting space in that team last year, and deservedly so. He had an incredible season and he is a very talented player and a very large man. And he kind of like, it's hard not to look at him when he's on the field because of how big and athletic he is. But on the flip side of that, you got Matt Smith, who oftentimes might be the smallest person on the field, could have been the biggest person in that moment. I would love to see that shift, to your point. When they see somebody who's having a great game, keep feeding them. And Matt Smith was having a great game last year in that playoff game, and it kind of just felt like he was an afterthought when it got down to crunch time.
Well, he's adding a plus one to his fan section. You talk about stepping up. He's got the biggest road ahead of him. I'm talking about him and his wife, Catherine, welcomed their firstborn child into the world today. So huge congratulations to Matt Smith, the person behind you, closest to you in your goal scoring record on the all-time leaderboard. he's one of those people who I think if you've met Matt Smith, played with Matt Smith, watched Matt Smith, he's kind of one, despite the unassuming name, he's someone who you always want a little bit more of. And I think it's just great that they're adding a little bit more of their family into the world. And so huge hats off to him. That'll be where we'll dismount today, because it's probably the nicest thing we've ever been able to say on this podcast so far. So don't want to spoil it with like ultimate Frisbee analysis. That'd be nasty. We'll get to more of that next week as we draw ever more closer to opening poll on April 26th. We are underneath 2 months now. Can't wait. Really starting to get excited. We'll talk to you soon. Bye now.